It's Northeast Delta Dental Radio with Tom Raffio.
Welcome to Northeast Delta Dental Radio. I'm Tom Raffio for Northeast Delta Dental Radio, and I'm also the head coach and CEO of the dental insurance company known as Northeast Delta Dental. Well, it's hard to believe it's already September 8th and 9th. Labor Day has come and gone. It's still very hot outside. The Fisher Cats have started their playoff run. The Patriots start tomorrow, Sunday. And for my running friends, just as a reminder, the halfway to St. Patrick's Day road race in Manchester is late morning Sunday, September 9th. So you can listen to this show at 7 a.m., do a little warm-up, and then head down to Manchester for the halfway to St. Patrick's road race. Also want to thank my running friends for a good turnout at the St. Charles 5K, the fundraiser for the orphanage. That race was on Portsmouth on Labor Day. And a big shout out to all of you that participated in the Friendly Kitchen 5K just this past Friday night. You know, we had a good turnout. So one of my running friends is sitting right beside me, Dr. Molly Rossignol. However, today is not about running, although we could do a little of that, right?
That would be okay with me.
Because it's actually relevant to one of the topics. It's actually the first question. So as you all know, Molly's a doctor, and she specializes in addiction medicine, and she's also a family physician. So let's start with that question. What is the difference between dependence and addiction? Because I'm thinking part of this question is there can be, like, some people say I'm sort of addicted to exercise or whatever, so that may not be a bad thing, whatever. But why don't we start with that question?
Okay. Well, Tom, this comes up often. In fact, it came up with a doctor friend of mine who was commenting on somebody who had been in a facility for a period of time and had been withdrawn from a substance. And they came back out, and knowing that they hadn't been exposed for a period of time, went back to using. And the physician was just stymied. He said, well, they suddenly weren't dependent anymore. Why did they go back? And so it really gets to the crux of what addiction is versus dependence. Now, dependence can be, you can develop dependence on all kinds of substances. Coffee, for example, you might get a headache. You'd have a withdrawal syndrome if you had drank coffee for a period of time and then didn't. But it may not be that you would do things in order to get coffee despite consequences. You know, if coffee was 100 miles away, you might not drive your car 100 miles to go get it. You might say, I can deal with the headache. With addiction is a neurobiologic change in the brain. And that has developed over a period of time or due to genetics that some people have, that not only is there dependence to a substance, but also a compulsion to continue to use a substance and a lack of control of using that substance or behavior. There are certain behaviors, certainly you mentioned running, or, you know, sometimes gambling falls into the addiction field. So it's more of addiction is represented by the compulsion, the use despite consequences, the lack of control, and the craving that also comes along. So even if somebody's not been exposed for a period of time, against their permission, they may have a craving for a specific substance or behavior.
Thank you. That was really helpful. So, you know, in your bio, it says you love to run. You used one of those two words.
Yes, okay. I did.
There you go. And of course, so you hit on my two issues, running or exercise, although I'm running so slow now, Molly, it's awful. As soon as I turned 60, like, I just went, like, from a pretty good 5K to, like basically a walking time. But anyway, so there's running and exercise, which I guess, you know, obviously even that, I suppose, could go to the extreme. But assuming that doesn't go to the extreme, that could be viewed as a good addiction.
Yeah, so one of the things when I think about, first of all, if we look specifically at the addictive disorders, there is a book, it's from the Psychiatric Societies, called the DSM-5. It's come out in multiple volumes, but the newest one's DSM-5 was published in 2013, and it lists addictive disorders. Now, exercise is not considered an addictive disorder. It doesn't fall in that chapter. Gambling does as a behavior, but there certainly are recognized behaviors that people can say, I'm addicted to food, or I'm addicted to exercise. And in many ways, I think the neurocircuitry really does mimic, and maybe we'll find eventually out that that the neurotransmitters are the same. But certainly, people can exercise despite consequences. I know of people who continue to run, myself, despite an injury, and try as I might to continue to run on despite pain. And so those are some of the things that you say, well, what happens if you don't run? Well, I don't know. I get a little cranky. I don't know about you, but I do get a little cranky. And that says to me there is a reward. There is a neurotransmitter reward. We produce endorphins. Our endorphins, in turn, then can create a dopamine reward for us. So certainly we're getting that. So it could fall in that at some point, but at this point, there's no specific diagnosis of running addiction. But
well, that's good, because two of my best friends, my wife Ellen and Tom Walton, they definitely get cranky if they don't get their run in or exercise. And that's why I love when they run, because it makes my life so much better. Now, I so badly wanted to get into this topic. I didn't even, read your very impressive bio. You obviously were a faculty physician at New Hampshire Dartmouth Family Medicine, and then you became board certified in addiction in 2015. And you're currently working at Catholic Medical Center as the principal provider at the addiction medicine outpatient practice, and you also consult on inpatients. So without naming, obviously, a specific patient, but what's the day in the life of Molly? What are you dealing with?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Now, on a daily basis, I have an outpatient clinic, as you described, and oftentimes the folks who call in to see me, it's either a family member, and oftentimes it's the mother, who calls in and says, my son or daughter needs to see you. And I'm not talking an adolescent. Usually that son or daughter is between the ages of 30 and 52. You know, this is a family disease where people really, really recognize the dire needs of their family members, and yet the lack of ability for that family member to seek help. So that's one scenario where I get calls for a consultation. It's either that, or it may be the patient themselves. And the patient themselves will call, and I'll say, did they get a referral? And they'll say, I didn't want to talk to my doctor about this. And so that's one of the things that comes up, is the stigma and the shame around this disease. And so I'm very happy that when I get those calls, and the first thing I say is, I'm so glad you called, because there certainly are treatments for this. And I would see a patient, I see several patients in the office for a variety of different addictions, alcohol being a prevalent one, opioids, of course. Cocaine is actually quite prevalent as well, and methamphetamine. Those are some of them that I see on a regular basis. In the hospital, unfortunately, I see very, very sick people. They're often admitted with infections, either soft tissue infections. Sometimes it'll be a lung infection, so they'll have little spots in their lungs that are abscesses. They'll have vegetations or growths on their heart valves, which is not uncommon. And that requires 6 weeks of IV antibiotics in the hospital. And so I like to be able to go and see a patient right away, start talking about what their desires are. You know, do they know that there is an option and an opportunity to start working on their wellness while they're waiting for the antibiotics to heal their bodies?
There's obviously a mental health component, to addiction. So how does that sort of multiple diagnosis, even though it's related, how does that get addressed in all this?
That's a really good question. So we would call that a co-occurring disorder. And one of the things that in the definition of addiction, which I would refer the audience to the American Society of Addiction Medicine webpage, because they have a nice short definition and a long definition. And my colleagues, who I have loads of respect for, worked very, very hard in coming up with the specific definition. But the definition of addiction actually says it's a primary disease. And what that means is that, I have patients who say, well, they were self-treating. They were treating because they were depressed. They were anxious, so they smoked pot. And that may be the truth. But if somebody has a proclivity or a predilection, or is exposed long enough, or an environmental experience, it could really be the start of a different neurocircuitry change. So I think of co-occurring disorders happening in parallel often. If I see somebody who is, often people, as I said, come in very shameful, feeling depressed, feeling hopeless, feeling like they are, there's just no way out, it may, for all intents and purposes, look like depression or really feel that way to them. And yet, when we are able to start to treat, both with with behavioral health intervention, with medication interventions, and time and hope, those kinds of things, providing for folks, some people will actually say, you know, I feel so much better. I thought it was depression. And then there'll be others who say, you know, I'm just not feeling well. I just, there's something else. And we will go through a variety of different screening exams, screening questionnaires to determine, is there a risk for depression? Is there a suicidal ideation? Is there somebody that we really need to jump on and start treating both things at the same time?
That was a great explanation because, you know, at the conference, everything seems so related, and it is, of course, just like you described. And the other thing, when I started into this, like I knew all, I have all the statistics, but when you actually hear the stories and you see it every day, I actually think it's worse than what the statistics, not necessarily, maybe the numbers are accurate, but the impact, you know, on the families. One of the outcomes for the conference in March is we created a rack card that we're giving out to law enforcement that has all of the different resources. Something as simple as that the police officers were telling me that sometimes they go in and the family is just they're at the end, at the end of their rope, and just can I call someone? So something as simple as a list of all the contacts, you know, such as NAMI and all the other ones I'm sure that you're familiar with. So welcome back to Northeast Delta Dental Radio. Here we are, September 8th and 9th. Labor Day has come and gone, and with me is Dr. Molly Rossignol, and we're going to be talking about addictions and substance abuse. And again, for my running friends, if you're listening to this on Saturday or Sunday morning, there's still time to do the halfway to St. Patrick's road race at the Wild Rover in Manchester around 10 on Sunday. So, Molly, you were named to the Committee for the Development of Opioid Prescribing Rules for Physicians. And so tell us about that. And also, one of the things that we've also tried to do with our participating dentists is so they understand, you know, their role in it as well. So tell us what that committee is all about and how you're educating the professional community on this.
Sure. So that came about in 2016. It was actually, I'm forgetting if it was December into January 15 to 16 or 16 to 17. So I apologize for that. But when it was originally a bill that was written up by a legislator, and the Board of Medicine felt it was important to review that bill and to, instead of putting that into law, to really putting it in the hands of the Board of Medicine, as the Board of Medicine oversees the licensees of our state. And so there were about, I want to say, 10 to 12 of us from various disciplines. We met for several meetings that lasted several hours to review what were the best strategies to reduce the risk for overprescribing and really to protect our patients. It includes just in 2000, I believe it was in 2010, I might have my dates wrong, we were able to, the legislature passed the PDMP, or Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, and I don't believe that went into effect until 2013 or 14. So we were able to actually look online and see scheduled medications. So a scheduled medication is one that has a higher risk for addiction, so it would include opioids, it would include benzodiazepines or ADHD stimulant medications, for example. So we're able to look online live and see if a patient is being prescribed a certain medication. So if a patient comes into the emergency department with, say, a broken leg or a severe pain requiring an opioid, the physician or provider can look online and see if they've been prescribed that medication before. So that was one of the components. The others include needing to let people know that these medications are opioids. They are at risk of overdose on them, combinations of them, not to drink alcohol while they're using them, to be aware that they may be impaired while they're driving, and letting them know that it can lead to potentially addiction.
I think just the general awareness. I know a lot of my participating dentists, particularly oral surgeons, and just kind of the general awareness, like you said, it's an opioid, and and so that's very helpful. Thank you very much. Let's talk about medication for addiction. So why is it, we've all heard of Suboxone. Why is it that only certain doctors can prescribe the generic version of Suboxone, which I will say it that way because I can't pronounce buprenorphine or whatever that is.
So the generic version is called buprenorphine. And buprenorphine, and I always say it rhymes with morphine. So if you say buprenorphine, okay. So anyway, it is a medication that it's actually an interesting story in that in 1914, there was a tax on any opium coming over from China. And isn't it funny, and this is all in policy, but suddenly there was a policy that said that no physician could prescribe a medication to help a patient with an opiate addiction. We knew there were morphine, people who were addicted to morphine. We created heroin so that we could treat morphine addiction back in the early 1900s. So in 1914, it was a tax law, but it turned out to be a prohibition law that we could not prescribe anything to help somebody. Buprenorphine was a breakthrough for that, in that we can prescribe that by taking a course, and it's called a waiver. We can go around the law. We can waive that law by sitting through this course and understanding this medication. And buprenorphine is really quite groundbreaking. It is not. It is a partial opiate, so it does hit the opiate receptor. It does not cause euphoria, and it also makes people feel normal. And it's quite astounding to see somebody go from feeling horrible in withdrawal to give them buprenorphine, and they say, I don't know why, but I feel so much better. And they can stay on it for a long period of time. It seems to stabilize their brain. It seems to stabilize a lot of their emotional components to their situation, and it allows them to get back to life and not be seeking illicit substances any longer. It's really quite something.
Well, ultimately, I mean, would someone on that generic of Suboxone, someone can't stay that on that the rest of their life, though, right? I mean, eventually do they? I mean,
it depends.
Really?
So,
okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy around that in the studies. Certainly any medical study, unfortunately, never goes beyond really about a year.
Right.
But what we're calling for is let's look at 5 years out. Let's look at 10 years out. So I have some patients who have been on it for 9 years.
Really?
I have some who decide after a year and a half they want to wean off of it. And I think eventually, if we do personalized, individualized medicine, this is a spectrum disorder. Some people are going to be able to get off of this, and some people won't. And it's going to figure out who can and who can't.
Now, opioids have been, you know, everybody's been reading about it, but I also know, you know, you're concerned about heroin, cocaine, fentanyl. So what are the other things that are out there, and can you talk about it a little bit?
Sure. So one of the things that comes up a lot, and I'm glad that I think our governor even commented on it, is when we're looking at treating this disease, we need to look at the whole of addiction. Addiction is the brain disease. It's the neurocircuitry change. And so if somebody has an opioid use disorder or an opioid addiction, it doesn't mean that they will have addiction to alcohol too. But I always tell my patients that this is the addiction highway in the brain, and the risk of putting a substance that has a risk for addiction into their system could put them, you know, at higher risk for having that addiction. Looking at the other components of addiction, if you take away the drug, you haven't treated addiction necessarily. You've treated a substance dependence, as we had talked about. But the addiction component, which is a brain disease, a mental health disorder, as you've commented on, is really something that then needs to be managed. And one of the negative effects of taking a drug away, we talk about if we don't run, we get disgruntled, we get, you know, irritated, we want to jump out of our skin sometimes. It's really learning how to manage those feelings. It's learning, what can I do to cope? And sometimes for folks with substance use disorders, they actually start exercising. And that's one of the things you can kind of rebuild and reintroduce reward and a good feeling to. Sometimes it's prayer and meditation. Sometimes it's yoga. But oftentimes the specific behavioral management has to do with a change in your thinking and a change in your connections. 12-step meetings are a place where people find solace often, and ways to change their thinking as well. So looking at the whole of addiction is really what I'm concerned with, not just saying, okay, let's play whack-a-mole, and now we got an opioid addiction, and we got that under control, and then we have to deal with methamphetamine, and then we have to deal with marijuana, and then we... And we've been dealing with alcoholism, which is the, you know, kills more people in our state than opioids.
Well, it's good you mentioned that it could possibly one outlet is the exercise and meditation. I finished a book with my co-author, Professor Burrell, on mindfulness and meditation as part of this. And in part of my research, you know, for that book, there was Dan Harris, who is a CNN news person, wrote a book. It's called Getting 10% Better or whatever. And he had a drug issue and used, you know, meditation to, you know, to overcome that. So thank you for sharing that. So thinking ahead in terms of future generations, obviously we've got to save the current generation. And as you know, it truly is an epidemic. So we also have to focus on the present. But in terms of thinking ahead, in terms of education at schools and businesses and the general community, what are your thoughts on that so future generations maybe won't be saddled with this?
Yeah, well, I think this starts significantly early on. I think kids in general, teaching them resilience, teaching them about the risks of using a substance, teaching them about, you know what, yeah, it's fun to change how we feel. I mean, kids... Who doesn't like to swing on a swing when they're six, you know, or go
I
on
I still
a,
do.
Right. Well, I get sick. but, you know, it's sort of that thrill, if you will, in recognizing that there are times and places for and activities to fulfill that need for feeling good, if you will. And teaching kids that there are healthy ways to feel good and then there are unhealthy ways to feel good. And having a tight-knit family, certainly fostering family time and having supports within schools, mental health supports as well. I think all of that is so critical in helping kids to recognize how to stay well and the risks that are inherent.
Great. So for the listening audience, we have this upcoming conference in October at the Groponi Conference Center on addiction and opioid and so forth, and we'll get information out that, and so there'll be some follow-up, and we have actually the Surgeon General of the United States will be in Little Concord, New Hampshire, to, you know, talk about it from a national perspective. We've got about 30 seconds, Molly, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you have to be on opioids, what are some of the strategies to reduce the risk of being addicted or getting an overdose?
So certainly if you have to be on opioids because of a moderate or severe pain condition, being sure that you're on the dose that is appropriate, that you don't, you're not prescribed so much that you get sleepy. You need to be aware of the other medications that you're on if there's any interactions. Avoid all other sedating substances, including alcohol, marijuana, even Benadryl. You know, those are kinds of things that I would advise people. And, you know, talking to your doctor about it and making sure that all of your physicians are aware of which medications that you're on. It is also important to make sure that your medications are kept in a safe place and that they're not you're not at risk for being victim of either theft or somebody taking your medications.
Thank you, Dr. Molly Reisignol, for your leadership. She can be found at the CMC Addiction Medicine Center at Catholic Medical Center. And thank you for your leadership in this and your practical advice and also, you know, being real about this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom, for your commitment to this as well.
Tom Raffio will return next weekend with more of Northeast Delta Dental Radio.